lost all of his
benefits
and his pension and all that. But what they did to those women, you know, they just basically said, you know, so what?
Yeah.
So what? And it was just like a slap in the face of these women. It was so horrible that he got away with that. And I was looking on the web this morning, and there's a picture of him back there standing. He's got this smirk on his face, and he's got his little beret on and his uniform and, like, a whole chest full of ribbons, you know. And like Gary Lacker says, I wonder what they did to get all those ribbons, you know. and his attorneys just laughing, you know, like, say, oh, this is done. Let's go get a cup of coffee. When, you know, when these poor women, you know, they were abused by this man. And nothing's going to happen, you know, happen to this guy. He basically got off free. And they also, at the same today, I think it was a midshipman at the Naval Academy who was charged with assault and the rape of another cadet, female cadet, at a party. And he got off today, too. He got off. And it was so horrible what the questions they asked that young woman, you know, during the trial. It was just so horrible. And he got off. He got off today. And he...
Yeah, that's double jeopardy, isn't
oh,
it?
Oh, boy. I tell you what. Women, I don't understand why women would go into the military. Plus, also in the military, there's the sexual assaults on men is really, really
oh, yeah.
high.
Oh, yes.
But you don't hear much about that. But it's really high in the sexual assault on men. Tammy, have we got Penny? Oh, great. And so the sexual attacks on men in the military is just unbelievably high also. And a little bit later, after we talk with Penny, we're going to talk about what happened to two veteran peace movement people at Cleveland High School. We're going to talk a little bit about that. But we're going to talk with Penny right now. Penny, like I said, she's the author of this great book, Hard Hat, Hippies and Hawks, The Vietnam Anti-War Movement as Myth and Memory. And like I said, she's an assistant professor of labor studies, which is amazing, at City University. Penny, we're glad to have you on the show.
Thanks. It's great to be here. Thanks
oh, it's our
me.
Pleasure. It's our pleasure. And your book is really, really a good book. There's a couple books out there that I have a huge library of books on the Vietnam War, and one of them that I have is Christian Appy's book, Working Class War.
Yeah.
And it's just amazing, but I'm telling you, your book is right up there with his. The stuff you talk about in this book is really right up there with Christian's.
Well, that's a major compliment, so thanks very much.
Oh,
it's
really a good book.
It's really a good book.
And how did you get interested in writing about the Vietnam War?
I was in graduate school in the early 2000s, and I mean, it probably goes back beyond before that. I mean, both my parents served in the military, and I grew up in a, you know, milieu surrounded by, you know, some vets and people who talked about the war and the military a lot, But when I was in graduate school in the early 2000s, I was doing sociology, and I wanted to study the relationship. I wanted to study social movements. I was a longtime activist, and I was active in my union. And
oh,
so
dear.
I wanted to look at class and social movements. And I actually thought that I was going to look at the environmental movement, and I was completely geared up to doing so when September 11th happened and mm-hmm. the war in Afghanistan began, and my activism, you know, went immediately into anti-war activism. And so for a few years, that's what I spent a lot of time doing. And because I was doing it from my union, I ended up meeting a lot of people who had been active during the Vietnam period as anti-war activists, and also a lot of veterans. Who started to tell me about this kind of counter memory that I talk about in my book.
Right,
and,
right.
And that's what kind of brought me into the project. And then I kind of dived into it, because what I wanted to make sense of was, you know, what were the class dynamics of the Vietnam anti-war movement? So I was kind of bringing the same question that I was going to bring to the environmental movement. I took it kind of back historically and looked at Vietnam.
Yeah, I want to talk about that too. One of the things that really interests me in your book, I'm going to read just this little part here, and I want you to talk about it. Our understanding of the socioeconomic division of the Vietnam era thus rests on two pillars. The anti-war movement was largely an upper middle class social movement led by the privileged radicals, with college students serving as its troops and supported by the sentiments of elite doves. And two, the working class distanced itself from or despised the movement, mostly supported the war and its makers, and was growing increasingly conservative during the war. And I got marked on the side, as Penny. So when I was reading your book, the book is just marked all up, Penny, from things, you know.
Yeah, you ought to see it.
It's really marked. So what's with that? What about this? What's
well,
going
so
on?
So at the beginning, you know, that's up at the front of the book, and what I'm trying to say there is that certainly was the story, you know, this idea of elites being, you know, the people who ran the movement and who rallied against the war, and working class people distancing themselves from the movement and often supporting the war. That was the story that I wouldn't say it was the story I experienced, but it was the story that I heard, and it was the story that I saw in movies and that I, you know, found in history textbooks. And it seems, my argument is that that's kind of the common sense that we have of the period. And, you know, so my whole book is challenging that.
Right.
My whole book is saying, you know, that wasn't the case. I mean, it's not like it wasn't at all the case. There were a lot of elites in the movement, and there were a lot of working class people who supported the war. But if you really look at the sentiments against the war, you find that working people, more often than college-educated people, were opposed to the war. You find that working class people in many, many, you know, vectors of the movement, many parts of the movement, not only participated but helped lead the anti-war movement itself.
Yeah,
and on the other side, you find you find elite support for the war. You know, so it's a much more complicated story than this kind of elite dove, working class hawk narrative lets us see.
Yeah, because I also it's really interesting at some of the statistics that you have in here about percentage for withdrawal of U.S. troops. College educated 60%, high school educated 75%, and grade school educated 80%.
Yeah.
80% of the folks percentage against withdrawal, 40% college, 25% high school, and 20% grade school educated. So the working class to me seems like they were right out there in the front.
Absolutely, and those numbers are from 1971,
right.
And that's what you see. Like at the, you know, at the beginning of the war, you had basically, I mean, most people supported it. Most people tend to support their, you know, their presidents, support countries when they go to war. But starting, you know, by 1968, the majority of Americans had become critical or skeptical of the war, and you see, you know, a kind of increasing number of people from working class backgrounds and workers say, you know, really questioning the war and really going out there and saying, you know, this isn't right, this doesn't make any sense.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. And it seems like all wars, Penny, like you said, all wars, that when they first start, that the country rallies around the flag, but as it goes on, it just kind of slips away.
Yeah.
And one of the things that was really interesting in your book, Hard Hats, Hippies, and Hawks, is the unions, how fast some of the unions came out against the war.
Well, yeah, I mean, I don't know how many of the listeners who are listening right now remember the 1960s, 1970s labor movement, but, you know, it was led by George Meany, who is the head of the AFL-CIO. I mean, he was the kind of figurehead people really looked to, or one of a couple of people that the media and most people identified with the labor movement. And he was incredibly supportive of the Vietnam War. I mean, he was, you know, anti-communist to the core, identified himself with the kind of anti-communist wing of the labor movement, which was the big dominant wing that had, you know, in the preceding decades really silenced the left and the communists who had been in the unions and who and many of whom had, had helped build, you know, the CIO and helped build the labor unions. So, yeah, so we look at the labor movement at that period as anti-communist, as pro-Vietnam, as incredibly hawkish, largely because of the ways in which the AFL-CIO, which was a big power player at the time, presented itself in public and spoke on behalf of the rest of the labor movement. But even in that period, you know, George Meany didn't represent, you know, more than, you know, half of his own unionists. In 1968, there was a poll done of unionists, and it showed that union members were half and half divided on the war. And, you know, but Meany was 100% for the war. Walter Reuther, who was the head of the UAW, which was the other, I would say, kind of, you know, Reuther was kind of the leader of the liberal wing, you could say, of the labor movement, as opposed to Meany's more kind of conservative and jingoistic end of things. You know, Reuther was distancing himself from the war, and in that, he was following a number of left-led and more progressive unions, unions that were closer to the social movements of the period, unions that were coming out of the public sector, unions that had more workers of color, that had more women workers. You know, those unions had already started to distance themselves from the war. Unions like the 1199, it's now 1199 SEIU, but the health and hospital workers, public sector workers. So Reuther and a whole bunch of other unions, you know, began to, you know, were breaking from the war in some ways from the very beginning, and after 1968 in increasing numbers. So by the time 1972 comes along, at the very end of the war, and this was a tough process for the labor movement. I mean, the labor movement had been, you know, gone through the Red Scare.
Oh, yeah.
Had, you know, was so fully anti-communist that to break from a war against communism, you know, was a big step for the labor movement at this moment. But it did, and I argue that the Vietnam period was the period in which labor began to kind of throw off the Cold War shackles that had really held it. And so by 1972, you know, you have a Labor for Peace initiative that pulled together fully a third of the unions in the United States.
Wow, I didn't know that.
Which is a really impressive amount of unionists.
Yeah, Bill has a question he wants to
ask. Yeah, I was thinking myself about, I'm an old-time union member, and it seems to me that working people have been under attack by the government for a long, long time in this country, and Taft-Hartley and those kinds of laws that were designed to take the energy away from the unions and take the power away from the unions. Mm-hmm. And the working people were so busy trying to keep themselves together that they didn't have a lot of time for extra activities that would hold them in good stead as far as their anti-war position.
Yeah. Did you find that when you were doing your book?
Yeah. I mean, that's a question that I really tried to think about, not just in the book, but in general. I mean, because everything you're saying, I think, is so right, and there are so many pressing major you know, kind of horrors in society then and now and attacks that come down on working people. And so it's always a question of how and when do working people who work one or two jobs, I mean, today, two or three jobs, you know, who even in this period, you know, that I write about in my book in the, you know, 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, you know, the post-war boom, the period that we associate with and we rightly associate with some of the, you know, best times for working people in the United States, even that time, you know, most working people were new to the kind of stability that, you know, that we now look back and say, wow, that was such a stable, fantastic period. It's like that was new for people. It wasn't as completely stable as the more mythic representations we had. You know, I mean, you know, there were periods of high unemployment. There were cyclical layoffs in different industries. You know, things were better than they were during the Depression and the war, certainly, but that doesn't mean that they were affluent, you know? Mm-hmm. And so given that, you know, when and how do people react, you know, to the kinds of attacks that they face and the kinds of pressures that they face? And the thing that I think about for that period is, you know, at different moments in our working class history and our labor history, unions and other organizations have played, you know, have often played significant roles in helping to orient people's kind of political activities and political beliefs and political actions, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And because, I mean, my own argument is, and, you know, I don't know what you think of this, but because of the Cold War, because the labor movement had distanced itself so much from the political engagement and critiques that really had typified it for the decades and decades before that. You know, I mean, the labor movement had always been, you know, engaged with, even if it wasn't itself radical, it was engaged in a conversation with radicalism. It was, you know, it took on, there were political fights that it took sides on for many decades. But during the Cold War, a lot of that was really silenced. So, I mean, I think that on the one hand, yes, it's very hard for workers to organize and to fight against the kinds of attacks that people find. But on the other hand, it's very, the kinds of roles that the institutions they're parts of play are really important. And I think that, you know, in Vietnam, the labor movement, the dominant labor movement, I argue, disoriented workers from really identifying, you know, what the, you know, what their stakes were in the war.
Yeah,
you know,
I think you're right. I think you're right that it really did that, because the war, if you really look in the war, like in Christian's book, in your book, that the working class kids, like myself, you know, I came from a very poor working class family, and most of the guys that I was with in Vietnam were all from working class families. And, yeah. You know, can you talk about that? The politics
Sure.
of that? Could you talk about that? The politics of the working class kids like me?
Well, I think that, I mean, you could probably talk about it, too.
But your book.
Christian Appy's book is really fantastic in that way, because he points out front and center that 80% of the soldiers serving time in the military during the Vietnam era and in the war itself, you know, were from working class and poor backgrounds.
Right.
So you have a military that's overwhelmingly working class, and that means, I mean, from my research, that means a lot of different things. I mean, partially that means, you know, these soldiers aren't the first in their families to go serve, right? I mean, often there's a tradition of service.
This oh, yeah.
Draft America, and, you know, most, you know, many fathers had served in World War II, and uncles, and, you know, communities had a very kind of proud record of service. So responding to the draft, you know, there wasn't the same kind of space for questioning that existed for a lot more, and I wouldn't say for all, but for a lot more of the elite or affluent families, you know. You know, there's a draft call. Well, that's what you do. I mean, that's right. What everybody did, you know. And so right off the bat, you have a different reaction to the situation than you would if you had come from, you know, hadn't come from generations of people who served or communities that had that kind of background.
Yeah, I think that you're right on that, because when you come from a family that, you know, has money and everything, you have the privilege, basically, of saying, yeah, I'm going to go or I'm not going to go. When you come from a very poor working class family who has a long history of military service, there's no question that you're going to go. I mean, you're right. going to go. Like at my family reunions, Penny, it was at one time. It was my grandfather had fought in World War One. I had 6-7 uncles that had all fought in World War Two. Wow. My uncle had died in Korea. I had 1, 2, 3 aunts that had served in the military. I had 3 or 4 of us that had served in Vietnam. And I had cousins now, some of their kids are serving in the military now. Yeah. And so there's this long history in the poor strata of our country who still don't question the military, don't question the government when they say we need your body. They're right there.
Who see it as, basic duty. I mean, my mom, when I was growing up, would say to me, and she was very opposed to the Vietnam War and mm-hmm. really critical of the military in lots of ways, and I don't know if she would say the same thing today, but when I was growing up, she would say, the 3 things you should do as an American citizen are vote, give mm-hmm. blood, and serve in the military.
Yeah.
And that's, that was just what she thought. Those are like your basic duties.
And one thing I know that you mentioned in your book is that you didn't want to criticize the military because our fathers served. You don't want to, say something bad about your daddy serving in the military, your grandpa or your uncles. You didn't want to do that. You just went along with what was going on. And once we got to Vietnam, I mean, with me, especially me and my cousins, when we got to Vietnam, everything changed, Penny. Everything changed. It was like when we came back, hey, wait a minute, something basically wrong. And we were very outspoken about it, except for my one cousin who was a combat medic. He's pretty quiet to this day, but he doesn't support the war. The one thing I want to ask you about that really interested me in your book was the movies. Movies about war.
Yeah, I spent a lot of in the beginning of the book. I write a lot about the kind of big, the most popular movies that have depicted the war. Or the ones that from like box office results and Academy Award recognition and that kind of thing. So I look at Born on the 4th of July, yeah. Platoon, Hamburger Hill, Forrest Gump, Apocalypse Now. These were really big and important films that helped a new generation, I think, like make sense of what happened in Vietnam.
Yeah, if you can make sense of it. That's
if you
the
can.
Problem.
Well, I mean, that was right.
Yeah, that's
I mean, that
the
was
problem.
One interesting thing is how unsettled, I mean, even all these depictions, you get the constant sense of this is a war that this country has not come to terms with.
Yes, still to this day.
Yeah. But in all of them, I mean, at least, going back to the kind of main argument in my book, in all of them, like the people who oppose the war or who are most articulate about their questioning of the war in most of these films either appear to come from or actually, according to the films, do come from, more elite backgrounds.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
That's one of the things that, my research, and again, I really relied on other people's work, for a lot of this, and I did archival work and looked at some of the GI movement records and the Vietnam Veterans Against the War records. But other authors like David Courtright, who did great work on Soldiers in Revolt,
right.
Point out the incredible questioning and, dissent and disobedience among American soldiers during Vietnam. I mean, what you said about when you got there, everything changed.
Oh, yeah.
The experience of, this brutal war where, the sides were backwards,
Yeah, like basically.
Where it's like where you're, fighting for South Vietnam, but you're actually, fighting against South Vietnamese people. And, all of the questions and that were being raised by the movement at home, you know, were directly experienced and directly kind of decided by people on the ground in Vietnam. And it's the resistance of the soldiers that I find, you know, the most dramatic of the period. And frankly, probably, you know, one of the leading causes for the war's, you know, change of direction and the withdrawal from the ground, you know, because from what I understand from the historical record, particularly the Army, you know, was not following orders.
No.
You know, the soldiers themselves were just disobeying the mm-hmm. orders
yeah.
to follow out to carry through the war. And there were reports in the armed forces journals at the time saying this is the morale is lower than it's ever been. And, mm-hmm. you know, there's, you know, we cannot continue to fight a war with this army that won't fight anymore.
Well, for one thing, it got to the point where the leadership was afraid of the grunts. The leadership was afraid of
right.
the rank and file soldiers, and so it was kind of a moot point for them. You know, we're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM here in Portland, Oregon, and we're talking to Penny Lewis, the author of Hard Hats, Hippies, and Hawks, and we're talking about the Vietnam War that she writes so well in her book. And the revisionist, do you feel that there's a movement going on now to rewrite Vietnam? Do you feel that?
You know, I'm worried a little bit. I mean, there certainly have been efforts to rewrite Vietnam, you know? I mean, and I feel like that's happened repeatedly, you know, since Vietnam. There continues to be a struggle for making sense of it. You know, with the 50th, you know, the 50th anniversary and commemorations
oh, yeah.
that are beginning, I think that it's going to be a period where I think we're going to have to be, you know, watching that
oh,
and
yeah.
intervening in these conversations, because it's going to be, you know, we're a country at war now, and it's not... The pressure is going to be on to kind of make of Vietnam a more stomachable war. And I read somewhere recently, I mean, and I actually have been meaning to go and look at the poll itself, but I read that younger people today who tend to be completely anti-war, I mean, that the majority of millennials and younger people are opposed to today's wars, but there is a decreasing number of people who think that Vietnam was a mistake.
Mm.
So if you poll people who were alive during the Vietnam era, strong majorities still believe that Vietnam was a mistake,
mm-hmm.
regardless of all the revisionism that's happened and everything like that. But if you look at people, like I think it was 35 and under, or 30 and under, it's fewer people think that Vietnam was a mistake. So that's a problem. You know, I think.
Yeah, I think you're right too.
And so I'm not really sure, you know, what is out there that would be actively revising Vietnam, because I haven't seen much sign of that. In fact, you know, I was very, I don't know if you all have seen the book by Nick Turse.
Oh,
the,
yeah, we interviewed Nick. Yeah.
Oh, you did?
Oh, yeah, Nick's a friend of ours.
So that, you know, that book, you know, made a lot of rounds, and a lot of people seem to have read it, and that book, you know, tells a very, very strong critical mm-hmm. story of the war. So anyway, I'm concerned that there might be revisionism, but as of this moment, I'm not.
I don't see it. Bill, did you have a question you wanted to ask Penny?
Yes, I was sitting here listening to the discussion, and I wonder if there isn't a need for war. Look what's going on in Crimea and Ukraine, and it's a replay of the Cold War tape all over again. And I grew up during World War II. I was 16 when it ended, and I was glad that it ended because I didn't want to go to war, but they caught me for Korea,
yeah.
and And it's been one war after another. And
yeah.
I've come to the conclusion, you know, I'd like to think a little more about the need for war.
Yeah, boy, yeah. Seems like every time we get in some trouble, they want to go to a war, Penny. They want to go to a war. Penny, I want to thank you. We're just about run out of time here. And I want to ask you one more question. The movies, I want to go back to the movies. Have you noticed when on television and everything that they start showing more war movies the closer they get to going to a war? Have you ever noticed that?
Yes, I have noticed that.
Yeah, I'm glad you said that because I see it.
I thought it was just me.
No, I mean,
rally the troops.
Feedback loop, our culture.
Yeah, rally the troops. Penny, can you give a real quick what you want people to get out of this book? Because it's really a good book. And what want to get people to get out of your book?
Well, I hope that I'm telling a history that has been kind of buried or ignored. So
right.
Part of what I want people to get out of the book is more nuanced and I hope more true understanding of what happened in the United States, you know, on the home front during the war in the anti-war movement. So people have a more full sense of what that movement, you know, was.
Mm-hmm.
And that's true for the people who participated in it and for the people who are learning about it as a historical thing. You know,
mm-hmm.
I've gotten so much really great supportive feedback from anti-war activists who have written me or contacted me to say thank you for for setting the story right.
Yes.
So that's been really gratifying. So that's one thing. But then the other thing is really like thinking about today's activists. You know, there are still major questions of class cultures inside of social movements,
mm-hmm.
meaning like people who are active inside of social movements, you know, do not necessarily work well with people different from them.
Right.
So you have different groups who are all kind of going towards the same goals, but who are not working together. And I would say in particular, movements that come out of more affluent backgrounds that maybe are more college-based or more kind of middle-class or upper-middle-class based, too often don't take seriously the reality of working class life and exactly the question like that you all asked me earlier, like, you know, working people are under attack, but, you know, when are they going to fight? How can they fight back? You know, so people are so busy and so pressed.
Join the union.
So the other thing I'm hoping that the book does is, you know, raise for people, you know, what the challenges are to have cross-class movements and to be thinking about the possibilities that exist and to realize that, you know, there are more allies and there's more commonality out there than some of our myths let us see.
Right, exactly. That's pretty good. That's a pretty good statement. And Penny, I want to say one more time that it's a wonderful book and I hope more
Thanks.
People read it. And if you write another book that I hope you do, and let us know, okay?
Oh, I will, absolutely. Thanks
we
so
would
much, and
be
thanks so much for having me.
Oh, it's our pleasure.
Come on
and we want to thank you again.
Thank you, Penny.
Thanks, Penny.
Yeah, thank
Bye.
You both.
Have a good one.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye. That was Penny Lewis, and she's written the book Hard Hats, Hippies, and Hawks, The Vietnam Anti-War Movement as Myth and Memory. And there's so much more in this book. We just got a little bit of it. I mean, the whole book is just really full of interesting and things that a lot of people don't understand. And what I want to talk about now is something that happened on March, I think it was 13th, where two anti-war veterans went into Cleveland High School, because we do have equal access just as the military has equal access to these schools. And Angie and Jeff went to Cleveland High School to be a part of this. When they got there, they signed in, and they noticed that the military hadn't signed in. They went to the room, and there were 10, I think Angie said 10 recruiters in this room with big plasma screen and all of this stuff to do this recruiting stuff. And like I say, we have access. We have the same access, and that's why they were there. Well, the military started taking up all the time, and Jeff and Angie had to literally get up and go to the front so they could talk. There's 10 recruiters there, remember. There's 2 anti-war veterans there. And you know how many students were there? 4. 4 students were there. And so, and Angie was saying that there really wasn't anybody from the school in charge, you know, to see that this thing was running right. Why weren't they there? Why weren't the Cleveland High School have a teacher there or the counselor there? There was nobody. She said there was a woman there, but she didn't know what they did. And also, Angie said that these recruiters were walking out into the hall, which they're not supposed to do. They're supposed to be in that room. And so they're just, you know, running roughshod over these schools. And Angie said when they got up there to start talking, they introduced themselves and they started talking, and they started talking about the things that the recruiters weren't telling the truth about. And these recruiters start stomping their feet, clapping real loud and talking real loud, trying to to block them out from what they were saying. There's 4 students there. And she said that one of them literally got up into their faces and put his forearm into their faces and said, I think it's time you leaved. It's time you leaved. Left. And so there was like this nobody from the school district in there to run this thing. You know, they were verbally abused. They were, the guy, you know, physically got into their faces and told them to leave, you know, when we have just as much right to do this. And Angie and Jeff finally did leave. But that, you know, there's something basically wrong with that the military is in these schools and they're running roughshod over these schools. And to treat these 2 veterans like they did is just horrible. And the way that these recruiters were acting so childish to these 2 veterans, they have to be called on that. The whole system that would allow these recruiters to do what they did and to get away with running through these schools with no supervision is just wrong. It's just plain wrong. And a lot of the guys in the Veterans Peace Movement are working on this. But if you're interested in that, call Cleveland High School. You know, call Cleveland High School and ask them why there wasn't somebody there to you know, make sure this thing ran right and everybody got a fair chance at it. And the principals at Cleveland High School's name is Paul Cook. And you can call him at 503-916-5120 and just ask him what's going on. Why wasn't the recruiters, you know, have to sign in and out like everybody else did? And why were they allowed to physically intimidate and verbally abuse those people, those veterans? And also call, yeah, the number is 503-916-5120. And that's for the principal of Cleveland High School. And if you want, call the superintendent. Call Carol Smith. She's the superintendent of Portland Public Schools. And ask her, why is the military getting away with all of this? Why, you know, we have equal access. And so if you want to call her and ask her about it, you can call her at 503-916-3304. And you can ask her why aren't they controlling this a little bit more? Why are these recruiters getting away with that? And if you want to call the recruiting battalion commander, call him, you know, and ask him why are his troops acting so childish, You know, what have they got to be afraid of? You know, to hear what other veterans, what veterans are having to say. Why are they so afraid? Why are they acting so childish? Why did they verbally abuse these two veterans? You know, why did they physically intimidate these two veterans? And his name is, this guy's name is Lieutenant Colonel. Well, that's not his name at his rank. But his name is Brian Ryder. And you can call him at 503-256-1431 or 503-256-1433. And as, you know, don't holler and scream at the guy, you know, even though he probably deserves it. But just ask him why is he allowing his troops to act like that? If they have nothing to be afraid of, why are they you know, allowed to do that? So these recruiters in these schools, we had them out of the Portland public schools for years, and until they got the, what was it, Bill? No Child Left Behind. No Child Left Behind, and that just let them get into the schools and just go you know, crazy. But to physically, and you know, verbally abuse these folks, and to physically, you know, threaten them, you know, that's basically wrong, and they should be called on that. That's just wrong. And I want to talk something else to you listeners. You know, you don't understand how much you've really changed things in Portland and in the United States and in the world by being a part of our radio show, because by letting us on the air, people around the world hear what we're saying, and you folks hear what we're saying, and you talk to other people about what we've said, and you have really, really helped a lot of people. You know, stay out of the Army, come home, and you've helped them get help. And you've done so much. Just you listeners have done so much on the anti-war movement that have done great work and have saved a lot of people's lives. And I can't tell you how much I appreciate you listeners, for the stuff you've done. And I just wanted, I've wanted to say that for the last 15 years or more, and to let you know how important that you are as anti-war people, is that the military just came out with a report about the anti-war, anti-recruiting movement in the United States, and they've done this report, and they are worried about it. They are worried about the anti-recruiting that's going on in this country. They talk about the stuff that we've said and the stuff that the Quakers have said and the Vietnam Veterans Against the War and all anti-war people have been talking about, and they've wrote it in this report, and they're worried. They're really worried about it. They're not saying that what we're saying is not true, because it is true, and they admitted it's true, but they say that it is a problem for them. That it is a problem for them. And by you folks listening to us and studying on your own and then going out there and doing things, you've done a great service to people. You really have done a great service to people. And I hope that you keep on doing it. I hope you keep listening to us, and I hope you keep studying and get out there and really, really talk. And we can really change a lot of things. If the military is worried about anti-recruiting, then we're doing something right. Yeah, if they attack us, then we're doing something right.
The wonderful people here at KBOO that are so helpful and encourage us in our efforts are there to be commended.
Oh, yeah. Just letting us on the air is a pretty brave thing. And I get messages from around the world, you know, people who've listened to this show on the Internet. And they talk about the things that we're saying and what you folks are doing, and we're so, you know, you guys are amazing, and I thank you from the bottom of my heart, and I know Bill does too. And Bill, you want to go ahead and start with Bridget?
Is Bridget there?
Hi, Bill.
Hi, Bridget. How are you?
I'm doing well. I'm glad to hear your show. It's going really well.
Well, give us a pitch.
Okay. I'd like to invite all women veterans who have not yet signed up to go to the website www.OregonWomenVeteran.com, and I'll go over that again real quick at the end of this. But go to the website, and I think you could maybe even just Google Oregon Women Veterans, but don't click on any ads. Just go straight down to the ODVA one, and it's running out. It's down to the wire. You need to make your mark on that website and say, yes, I'll come to this year's Oregon Women Veteran Conference. It's held every 2 years, and this time it's in Eugene, and it's supposed to be a very nice event, lasting 2 days, March 28th and 29th. It's an all-day event, and in fact, on Friday night, there's a social that you can still get in on. It's a Crazy Talk social, and it ought to be a lot of fun. During the days, they have seminars that'll help you sort out your benefits, and also it'll help you sort out some of your service opportunities or issues that you may have. There'll be lots of chances to network with other women veterans. I'd like to encourage every woman to take a chance and go to this website at www.womenveteran.com. It's a plural women and a singular veteran, and it's ready for you. Come one, come all. Thank you, Bill.
Bridget, could you give us a little bit about your background as far as the military is concerned?
Bill, in the 1970s, I was taken with the fact that the unemployment was down to about four ads in the newspaper. I had no money for college. The war was winding down, and all of us high school students were also being accosted at that time to join the military, get a college career, so that's what I did. So in the 70s, I joined the Air Force. I got the GI Bill. I got out and went to college. And once again, I landed on the economy when the jobs, they just weren't there. And so National Guard was trying to solicit my help, and so I didn't learn my lesson the first time, and I joined the Army Guard, but I spent longer and had a better time of it. I think, you know, at the time that I was in, the National Guard was an okay thing to do, but it's changed so much, I can't even recommend the National Guard anymore. There you go, Bill.
Thank you very much, Bridget. I hope your convention is a success, and that this bit of advertising on the program will result in recruiting a few of women veterans, because women veterans are not getting the recognition and the
acknowledgement
that they deserve.
Well, thank you so much, Bill, and I bet you there are women that will hear this call and this radio show, and you know, go to the website and maybe come on down when they wouldn't have otherwise known about it. And so this will be an opportunity to network with other women veterans and learn a lot about what opportunities are out there.
Oh, great. Bridget, thanks a lot. And really appreciate it. And keep up the good work, okay?
Okay, Marvin. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, yeah, no problem. Hang in there.
Okay, thanks.
Bye.
Thanks.
The women veterans is something, too, I wish we would have talked to Penny about, because women veterans do not ask for help very much. Women veterans don't use the VA as much as they
are entitled to.
Entitled to. They don't apply for disability that they're entitled to, and they just seem to just, you know, because being a woman in the military is not an easy thing. It's not an easy thing.
Even being a boy in the military.
Yeah, being a boy in the military is not an easy thing either. But being a woman in the military is even harder.
Double whammy.
Yeah, and so it's not a good thing. We will be back next next month, we'll be back on April 18th at our usual time at 9 a.m., and we're going to be interviewing Jerry Limerick. And Jerry Limerick is the – we interviewed him before. He did wrote the book on the spitting on veterans when they returned, and how he showed that that was just not true. And he also wrote this book about Jane Fonda and how she was kind of used by the right-wing neocons, you know, as a centerpiece to go after the anti-war movement. That she was – she didn't do anything any different than anybody else did, but she was a high profile and she was a woman.
Yeah.
And so they went after her. And he's written a really good book on that. And he's written this new book he's written. It's on PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. And he talks about how – well, I'm not going to tell you until till we interview Jerry on the show. He's a Vietnam vet, so he definitely understands. And so, again, we're just about out of time. And I want to, again, thank – all of you folks out there who do this wonderful anti-recruiting that's going on, that's really making a difference. And if you want to be a member of KBOO, if you listen to KBOO, you listen to our show, you listen to the other great shows on KBOO, go to the KBOO webpage, kboo.fm, and there's a tip jar right up on the right in the right-hand side. You can click on that, and you can just fill that out, and we can keep this thing going. In fact, I got an email from a guy in Arkansas, Jim, and Jim is starting a community radio station in Arkansas, and he found out about our show, and they're just now starting to work on it, and they're going to be up and going fairly soon, I believe. And it's another anti-war radio station out there. And we keep doing it. We do it one at a time. We just talk to each other, and we can get this going. When the military writes a report, worried about the anti-war movement, worried about the anti-recruiting movement, then we're doing something right. And thank you, Tammy, for being here again. And we'll be back, like I say, on April 18th at 9 a.m. here on KBOO 90.7. And there it is.
At the end of the early British wars, the young land started growing, the young blood started flowing, but I ain't a marching anymore. For I've killed my share of engines in 1,000 different fights. I was there at the little big horn. I heard many men lying, I saw many more dying, but I ain't a marching anymore. It's always the old to lead us to the wars, always the young to fall. Now look at all we won with a saber and the gun. Tell me, is it worth it all? For I stole California from the Mexican land, fought in the bloody Civil War. Yes, I even killed my brothers and so many others, but I or I march to the battles of the Germans.
This is KBOO Portland, and time is 10 a.m. right now. And coming up at 10, Eric Cascady is off today. We're going to hear Flashpoints. Native American activist Rod Coronado speaking about his battle to protect wolves and other predators from extinction. Vermonters are pushing for a public banking system, and we'll have a special report from Moscow, Idaho, on grassroots resistance to the tar sands pipeline. At 11 on the Radio Zine, host Michelle Schroeder-Fletcher interviews John List, co-author of The Y Axis, Hidden Motives and the Undiscovered Economics of Everyday Life. And thank you, KBOOM members, for your generous support. As Marvin was saying earlier, you can become a member right now when you go to kboo.fm and click on Donate Today.
Sing songs, it'll prove to you that this is your world, and that if it's hit you pretty hard and knocked you down, for a dozen loops, no matter how hard it's run you down and rolled over you, no matter what color, what size you are, how you're built, I am out to sing the songs that'll make you take pride in yourself.
I'm Lori Sonnenfeld.
And I'm Don Jacobson.
Together we bring you Moving On, Fridays from 12 noon to 1:30.
We feature both traditional and contemporary folk music.
We love to present live in-studio concerts from local and national musicians.
Tune in and you'll hear music that is socially progressive, moving, and heartfelt.
Music heard only on the left-hand edge of the dial and only on KBOO.
Every Friday, noon to 1:30.
We who believe in freedom cannot
KBOO is proud to co-sponsor the Triangle production Next Fall. Next Fall opens March 13th and runs through April 6th at the Sanctuary, 1785 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. Triangle Productions is partnering with Basic Rights Oregon in a talkback presentation after the show, which is set in present-day New York and contains flashbacks through a couple's relationship, how it began, and how it might end. Again, that's Next Fall by Triangle Productions, running through April 6th at the Sanctuary. More information can be found on the right-hand side of kboo.fm under Community Events.
Flashpoints, warrior for the animals, Native American activist Ron Coronado speaks out about his battle to protect the wolves and other predators from extinction. Also, Vermont is pushing for a public banking system. And we'll have a special report from Moscow, Idaho on grassroots resistance to the tar sands pipeline. I'm Dennis Bernstein. All this straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Coming up later on in this broadcast, you're going to be hearing from a very important person talking about how to rescue the banking system from the corporate monsters. Incredible interview. We're going to also be talking with Helen Yost from Wild Idaho Rising Tides about their battle with tar sands in, well, eastern Washington and all over the place up north from here. But first, we're delighted to have in the studio warrior for animals and the earth, Ron Coronado. He's a long-time Native American activist, Pascua Yaqui activist, affiliated with the animal rights movement, Earth First, and other groups who the government has gone to great lengths to imprison and silence. And boy, they did give that a real shot with Ron Coronado. Let me just tell you a little bit about what he's been through, and then we're going to talk about those wolves. After first gaining notoriety in 1986 for sinking an unoccupied Icelandic whaling ship with Sea Shepherd cohort David Howitt, Ron Coronado was later imprisoned for the 1991 torching of a Michigan University lab conducting research for the fur industry. He wrote from prison in 2006 while serving another sentence for disrupting a mountain lion hunt by dismantling a trap. After reassessing his strategic approach, he says, "Don't ask me how to burn down buildings. Ask me how to grow watermelons or how to explain nature to a child." Nonetheless, he was still stalked and surveilled by law enforcement and arrested after giving a public talk in San Diego when he answered a question about the past direct actions. police claiming that he was instructing people on making incendiary devices. He was sentenced to 1 year while on probation. After the sentence, was charged with a parole violation for a Facebook friending of Earth First co-founder Mike Rozelle, who's been on this show, and we're always glad to have him as well. After serving 4 months for that charge, the feds restarted his very restrictive 3-year probation term, whereby he was disallowed from communicating with any activists. Finally, that probation is ended, and Coronado is able to pursue advocacy work for wildlife. And, well, we're glad you made it through all of that.
Thank you so much, Dennis. Thanks for that long introduction and welcome to KPFA.
I just wanted to, thank you.
Honor. Sorry my rap sheet's so long. It took so long for you to go through all of that.
Well, I just wanted people to get a sense of what somebody who has really devoted their lives to protecting wildlife and protecting the animals and the environment that we all count on, what you've been forced to go through for just that. It's important.
It is. It is important because it has a, you know, political context here with everything that's been going on in the left with the post 9/11 atmosphere that's been created when all the extra resources and counterterrorism has been misdirected to environmentalists and animal rights activists. So that fell heavily on those of us who were engaging in some illegal activity, and I can't say that I don't understand why it happened, but I am glad to no longer be focused solely on my own self-defense and to be focused back where the attention is really needed, and that's on endangered species. And it's sad at the same time to have to come back into working on an issue such as the wolves, you know, which was one of our greatest victories, you know, in the Endangered Species Act was the recovery of gray wolves. So, but, you know, I'll go where the need is, and I'm glad to be back and talking to your listeners and people here in California, and at the same time welcoming back the presence of wolves here as well. That's amazing news that I've become aware of since my travels here.
Oh, welcome home. Welcome home to the environment. And let me ask you to talk about, in terms of the relationship between indigenous communities.